Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike DeSop, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. Our episode this week begins with a quote. "The only person who's surprised is the guy who's been here for 31 years. This quote is from our guest this week, and it was just one of the many times during the interview when he mentioned an instance where things that just seemed normal to him in his everyday job of managing cattle, using these new grazing practice methods, was producing results that were shocking to his colleagues and producers who'd seen cattle graze this same land for decades. That guest is Eric Chia. Eric is an active duty U.S. Army Special Forces major serving as a full-time faculty member with the Naval Postgraduate School. Based in Camp San Luis Obispo, California, Eric is leading a groundbreaking proof of concept program with the U.S. Army, specializing in the implementation of regenerative agricultural and grazing practices aboard the installation. The program is called Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab, or RGOL for short. This proof of concept is designed to enhance soil health, improve land management, restore ecosystem functionality, and increase DoD installation resiliency. In this episode, we dive immediately into the details of this proof of concept program, how they've trained these animals, why the DoD is even interested in these practices, the near immediate benefits that they've seen in the cattle's grazing and behavioral habits, and Eric's plan for this program to expand and outlive him.
Thanks for having me on here. It's really been just an incredible blessing to be here at Camp San Luis Obispo in California, this National Guard training base. So right now I'm running a proof of concept for the Army, really focused on implementing regenerative grazing on DoD land. Right now, we're on 2,500 acres that's grazable, running about 140 cow-calf pairs. And we are doing baseline measurements, like water infiltration. We're going to do carbon pulsing, microbial populations, invertebrates, bird and wildlife, biodiversity, plant biomass, all sorts of really cool things. And then after the first year and then annually, we're going to keep measuring. We're going to see that we actually are, we're improving. I got to like pinch myself every now and again, because I think I'm the only major in the Army who's on orders to do amp grazing. I mean, this is so cool. That I get to ride out there in this, you know, beautiful rangelands, these beautiful training areas, and I'm out there with polywire, side by side or four wheeler, and we're out here moving these cows every day. It has been a lot more challenging than I thought it was going to be. Some really difficult terrain that we have out here, but luckily, when we developed this proof of concept, we said what we need to have is some mentorship, so some consulting. So we partnered with Understanding Ag, who sends out a grazing consultant.
Yeah. Yep.
Who comes out here, and Kent Donica spent a week with myself and my wife, and I mean, we just, you know, did a week in the life with us, and I mean, his tips were just invaluable. So again, we're kind of the proof of concept. We're the first ones doing this on Army land, and really what we want is to expand this inside of California, but also to other DoD bases that either have grazing programs or are thinking about implementing one.
So just some logistical points to get straight here first, and then. You're active duty still.
Yep.
Your main job right now is this rangeland and grazing management. Is that correct? Like for the next 2 or 3 years, your tour of duty is this project.
Yeah, this is definitely my main focus. I work for the Naval Postgraduate School.
Okay.
Which is where I got my master's degree. And this is what my thesis partner and I, Ian, wrote our thesis about this. How do we implement regenerative agriculture? We really focused on adaptive multipadic grazing.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do that on DoD land? You know, it is a unique context. You know, there not too many ranchers are concerned about what the effects a tank would, you know, have.
Right.
In one of their pastures, but that's like something we concern ourselves with, you know, as we're working on this. Camp San Luis Obispo, although tanks aren't driving through here, you know, just the other about maybe it was a month ago, we had the best warrior competition. And so there's people out there doing land navigation, and we have cows in the same area. And so part of the safety brief was, when you come across poly wire, here's how you defeat it. You know, you step on it, you push it to the ground, and then you continue mission.
Right.
And so we actually got some cool pictures of some guys doing land nav, stepping over the wire, and no cows got out. No one got shocked, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
We didn't.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just a really cool way that, you know, we can continue to both have a win for the local ranchers, the agriculture producers, as well as improve training land simultaneously. You know, so we have training going on, and we have, you know, we have improved water infiltration, we have improved carbon, we have biomass removal that we want. You know, we have thatch, you know, out here in California, this fine fuel load management is a big deal. And so we can provide that with this targeted grazing.
So you got your master's as a student there over 2 years, and then you essentially stayed, and now you're a part of the faculty. Is that right?
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. Thanks to the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment, Honorable Rachel Jacobson. She funded our research. You know, we presented this
got
to
it.
Her. We said, hey, we really think that this is how the Army should manage these. You know, the Army has 13 million acres of land. 26 million is all of DOD, but half of that just belongs to the Army. And so we said, hey, if we're going to give land access to producers, this is how we should be managing. You know, do we want clean air? Here's your answer. Do we want better drinking water? Here's our answer. Do we want reduction of fuel load? Here's our answer. You know, it's just kind of a win-win-win as we went down the list. And she agreed to essentially give us the seed money to get us started for these 2 years here.
How is that managed now with the Army?
There's the conservation reimbursable program, where it's kind of just typical leases. You know, like if you were to want to lease some acreage to do grazing, that's your focus. These leases look very similar.
Huh.
They go through the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, who are kind of the real property managers. And that's how there's a bidding process, just like a normal lease.
Okay.
And, you know, typically it's the highest bidder that wins. And what we're saying is, we need to be very selective about the type of practices that we implement. And so, you know, this, if we're concerned about erosion or dust, if we're concerned about wildfires, then we should implement some of these best practices, which, you know, that's why we're looking at adaptive multipadic grazing, because the data we're looking at says this is good for all these reasons. This unlocks the suite of benefits. So let's implement this.
Got it. It's not so much that this idea of leasing this land to private producers is new. That's been going on, and that's how it's done now, but rather the practices that these producers are employing are better for not only their product, but also your product as managers of this land in and of itself.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why do you think that matters to the DoD? that this land is managed in this way as opposed to the more conventional way.
Sure. Yeah, the conventional set stock
yep.
grazing versus adaptive multi-paddock grazing.
And it probably makes sense to explain that to folks sure. that maybe haven't heard that phrase before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first I would say, you can listen to me, but I would also then say, go watch there's a docuseries called Roots So Deep, You Can See the Devil Down There.
Okay.
Peter Bick.
Okay.
And Dr. Alan Williams is the amp guy. He's on that documentary. He's all part of it. And that would be a great weekend, in my opinion, would be to sit down and watch those four watch that whole docuseries. It's four episodes. And they really go into the science of adaptive multi-paddock grazing, what it is and what it's not. But just in simplest terms, it's biomimicry. So we're emulating the herds of bison, elk, deer, antelope, pronghorns that roam from the East Coast to the West Coast. So we're hitting areas, we're grazing areas very controlled for a set amount of time. And then it's adaptive because it's not the same every single time, right? I'm not building a 10-acre paddock followed by a 10-acre paddock followed by a 10-acre paddock. I'll use a single poly wire, an electric wire, which the cows have been trained to. And then we'll move them. We have a call, come boss. They just come walking toward us. And they move into their next paddock. And so that paddock is based on forage availability. You know, what season are we in? Is it dormant? Are we grazing stockpile? Are we grazing something in vegetative state? There's all these measurements that I get to do. And then we move these cows in there. And then I get to observe. And I get to say, well, it's been a day. You know, they've eaten about a third. They've trampled a third. Maybe I want to leave this third behind. And so that's trigger. That's, I see that. And okay, it's trigger now for me to move on. And there's other areas where I go, okay, yesterday they had 10 acres today. And that was a little too much. So today I'm going to go down to about 7 acres because it's pretty similar. And we're going to see how that works. So the beauty of it for me is if I make a mistake, it's a day's worth of mistake. You know, I didn't make a mistake for 3 months. And I thought, oh man, we really just burn this place to the ground. It looks like a golf course out there. You know, if I made a mistake, it was on that 10 acres and the rest of the, you know, 2,490 that I have to play with out here, I can take those lessons learned and apply them the very next day and again and again and again.
Okay.
So it really allows you to be adaptive. And that was great when we had Understanding Ag out here to consult with us, you know, because I'm in it, you know, you're in the grind and that's what you're seeing too. You know, when folks are just in it and you're able to come in and give a fresh perspective, how valuable that was for me. Because I'm in this. I'm like, this isn't going to fail. I'm working hard, you know, I'm climbing up hills,
right?
You know, I have a rubber mallet to get these stepping posts in, you know, because the ground was so hard, that's not going in. Yeah. And Kent was like, hey, buddy, you might need to give them a little bigger today. You know, you can give them a little bit. You're not wasting it. You know, it's kind of, think of it like a bank account. You're not wasting the grass. Or you can come around and get it next time as the soil improves, as I'm able to put these stepping posts. But that's kind of a long drawn out explanation of amp grazing. But I would, again, really encourage that Root So Deep docuseries. That is awesome.
And then why does it matter to the DoD? Why would they be interested in this practice as opposed to the traditional methods?
I think we surprise a lot of folks when we talk about the Army and stewarding the environment, or the military really in general about stewarding the environment. I mean, every DoD base has an environmental office, you know, that is very intertwined into the training and operations of that base. You know, that's like a consideration. We had, you know, I was in North Carolina, we had the red-cocketed woodpecker, you know, and if that thing shows up, you're shutting it down. Like, you're not training on there because that was at the time, it was a endangered species. You know, you're not training there. So when we said that we have data supporting that this practice actually increases biodiversity, and that our goal would be to, whatever the endangered species is, like we would look for ways to measure and then see if we're increasing that population. So that was one thing that got them excited. The other was the level of control that we have of the livestock. So this poly wire, this, you know, single plastic wire with, you know, metal filament in it is really all it takes to control the cattle. You will have your fence jumpers or ones mm-hmm. who push against it or want to stick out, and they're just not fit for the program. But for the vast majority of them, that, you know, we've been moving just fine. In fact, it's kind of interesting that we were doing a big move from one 500 acre pasture, which we had subdivided a whole bunch, but we're moving them out of that one to a new one. And so the gentleman who owned the rancher who owns the cattle and owns the lease was out here. His son was out here. They had laid the fence down, and they're like, "Oh, surely these cattle will just walk right over this fence. You know, it's laying on the ground. We don't need to reel this thing up. Let's go." And sure enough, those cows said, "No, no way. I am not going near that thing." And they were just peeling around. Yeah. So this level of control, you know, I mean, we're on the installation's goals is to train. Right. I think everyone who's been in the military knows, like, hey, we're here to close with and destroy, and we're going to train to fight America's wars. So the grazing is not the main effort. So our level of control has to be, really strict. You know, we need to control these animals. And so that was one thing we were able to point to them. And then we had our sponsor, Colonel Vitale is his name. He came out from that Office of Installations, Energy, and Environment. He came out, and we gave him a day in the life out here. And that was one of his big takeaways, was the level of control we had of these animals. You know, I put him in the side-by-side, and we were driving out there. I started yelling, "Come, boss." And, you know, the cows are sticking their head in the UTV right up next to him. You know, he's been working in the Pentagon, so he's loving it.
You're right, right.
This is awesome. I'm out here in the field with the boys. He just saw that was so different from, yes, it was what we were saying, but to see it in person was great for him. So, I mean, the environmental benefits, yes, and then the control were two things that really stuck out to the DOD as why this would matter.
Is there thought that this management practice becomes a food security benefit for the base
mm-hmm.
when or if these animals become a food source for support personnel?
I'm so glad we're thinking definitely the same. So we've talked to the base here, the dining facility manager, and by no means are we saying, hey, we're gonna, you know, butt out your existing contract. Correct. That you have with whoever it is, but we want to create a resilient supply chain alongside of that. And so, you know, these beef, you know, we're a little different right here. We're cow calf, right? But if we were running, you know, stockers, right, or yearlings, or finding something sourced locally, you know, grown right here on the base, or just keeping some, you know, mm-hmm. some that weren't going to be replacement heifers, or if they weren't going to be sold as feeders, you know, we keep them here on the base, and we're able to graze them and eventually put them back into the program, because we want soldiers eating nutrient dense food, you know, not just, you know, the food security, but also we want, you know, phytonutrient dense food. And there's some really cool work done by, you know, Dr. Alan Williams and Dr. Stefan Van Fleet about just the phytonutrient properties of food grown on healthy soil, you know, and just how rich that can be. And that, I mean, that's what we want to be putting back into our servicemen and women.
Right. When we were, we looked at this with Ben and Miramar
mm-hmm.
Before he had sort of left that position, and it was something similar, was to provide these sort of closed containerized ag shipping container type situations for food source for the Marines on the base. And I spent a couple of days down there with the base CO and their team, and like it was a resonating idea insofar mm-hmm. as even he was saying they have graveyards of old aircraft fuselages, specifically the Hueys. And he was thinking, can we bring one of these old Huey fuselages or several of them back in and repurpose them for containerized ag type setups for food sources for the base, victory gardens, I mean, all sorts of stuff like that. So I had to ask because it was sort of top of mind in that if this has the environmental benefits that you're describing that are accretive to the base, could it also be a food security aspect for the base? And it sounds like it potentially it could be.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the direction we want to go. And I think, I mean, maybe it's just the military, because I talked to a lot of us, and I'm in the military still, is that like, we get this. We're like, wow, this absolutely makes sense. Why would we rely on something shipped in from, you know, many states away when it's being grown right here? Or just like you and I, you know, if you're the team leader, you know, and I'm your XO, or you're a company commander, I'm your XO, we're not riding in the same helicopter. You know, like there's a bump plan, we're separated, you know, so if something happens to your aircraft, you know, I can land and still take control. Like there has to be redundancy, there has to be resiliency in our system, and our food systems, not, you know, it's not any different. You know, we don't want to be completely reliant on one thing and then, you know, just put our hands up when that doesn't come through.
Right. What's the rule of are sort of following when you're making decisions daily, it sounds like, on pounds of animal per acre of forage required? Or is that even the way that you're determining how much to fence off per day? Or are you using some other metric?
Yeah, there is. That's a good thing to talk about. You know, we talk about stock density versus stocking rate. So pounds per acre is our measurement that we'll use. And right now, you know, we have cows in peak lactation. So I go out there with my grazing stick. So here's my little scenario that I go through, and this is how I would like explain it to people. So there is like videos you can watch on how to measure this. But I would take out my grazing stick, and I'm going to say that there is 80% coverage of where there is 20% that's missing. So there's bare soil on 20% of the surface, 80% is covered, or there's a root, you know, there is grass growing out of it. So 80%, which would equate to 200 pounds per inch, and then we'll go with that. 14 inches is our average height. So you do 200 pounds times 14, that equals 2,800 pounds of available dry matter.
Right.
In that paddock. And then we're gonna say we're only gonna take half of it though, because I don't want this thing to be scalped down to nothing. Let's just say I'm only going to take half in this one. And so then you say it's not truly 2,800 pounds. Yes, that's what I have, but I only want to take 1,400 pounds of dry matter per acre. And then we have, let's go with the scenario of 35 cows. And they're big cows, they're 1,300 pounds, and they're calving, which is what we're about done. We're done calving now over here, but they are bigger cows. They are about that 1,300 pounds. So we go 3.5% of their body weight in forage per day.
It sounds like you're also moving very frequently every day.
Yeah,
that has seemed, and is that unusual?
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. That's why I was like, because most of these folks will move, you know, a couple times every month, maybe even less than that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But this is much more of kind of an experimental setup where you guys are trying to see, let me turn that into a question then. Is it more of an experimental setup?
Yeah. I mean, for us, it is, but I would tell you that there are a lot of people who are doing this. There's people who are moving their cows four times a day.
That's crazy. You know, Okay.
I mean, it, a lot of people go like, oh, it, you know, that must take you so much time, you know, and we're doing this at what we started at like one, you know, I'm done for the day. You know, I was done, you know, it, so it's not these like super long, huge, drawn out days. You know, when you have your system and you're in it, it goes by pretty fast. And I'm not out there building fence all day, every day. We put in a few longer days where we'll build paddocks ahead of time. And then I can adjust those based on the previous day. So
Right.
it's not, a lot of people go, oh my gosh, you know, to do that, you'd have to have so much cost and labor. And I mean, really, it's not that. Initially, it was really hard. I'm like, man, I must be doing something wrong. But that's where the consulting comes in, and they go, hey, whoa, there's an easier way to do this. You know, we say there's smart rangers and strong rangers, and I was being a strong ranger. You know, like there are smart ways to do this, and that's really, we picked up some of these. I mean, little things from the type of posts we were using. You know, that was a game changer. We went to these small fiberglass posts that I just would tap in with the 2x4 instead of using the ring top posts that just, the ground wasn't ready for it yet. You know, it was dry. We weren't having any luck getting those things in. I was breaking them all the time. And so that was one of the things that Kent showed me. He's like, why don't you just try this? Boom, boom, tapped it in onto the next. You know, whereas each post for me was an emotional event.
How long? So these are Angus, correct?
Yep.
Okay. How long have you been doing this, and what sort of benefits have you seen up to this point?
So we're about 3 months in, so we're still very new to this, but you know, so what I have seen over 3 months, you know, I is not all that different to me. So I rely on the rancher who's been here for 15 years, who has been an incredible partner. And when we brought this idea to Honorable Jacobson, our, you know, our sponsor, she said, you know, find an installation who's willing to do this. Like it's got to be bottom up. You know, I don't want to force feed this. Find people who'd want to do it. And we looked at a lot of different places, and we just kept coming back to Camp San Luis Obispo. We met Mark and his son Blake Simonin, who have been, again, they've been here for 15 years. And you know, I proposed the idea to them, and I said, really, this is your lease. You know, this, we're not going to do anything without, you know, you saying you're okay with this. And he said, you know, I'm not going to get in the way of progress. You know, if what you're saying is true, you know, because there are things we wanted to see, yes, environmental benefits, but you know, we're seeing higher weaning weights under this type of management, you know, because we're moving them to essentially a greener grass every day, right? And so he said, all right, I'm willing to be part of this. Let's try it. So when I had Colonel Vitale from our sponsor's office come out and visit and do that day in the life I told you about, where he was sitting in the UTV and the cows were poking their heads right in there, we ran into Mark. I didn't plan this. I couldn't have planned this. It was too good. But I said, hey, Mark, you know, this is Colonel Vitale. He is a huge part in getting us the funding to do this. Can you kind of tell him from your perspective, you know, what have you been seeing? And Mark said, oh, that's great. Yeah, sure. He said, this is wildly different than what we had done in the past. There are hillsides that, you know, in my 15 years out here, I've never really seen cows on it or seen them graze that. And Eric had them, you know, on an 8-acre hillside, and they removed this thatch layer that I didn't think they would eat. He's like, I'm seeing them seek out things that they hadn't previously gone after. You know, we've actually been seeing these cows really, really smack coyote brush. This kind of, this, like they're not, I mean, when I move them into a new one, they'll see that and they'll just go right for it and hit it. And so they're actually like eating things that I mean, he was like, I didn't think the cows would eat that, you know? So, and also like the manure distribution is something that he's really been impressed with, is that I mean, it's almost like an application, you know, because we have them there, but only for a short amount of time. We'll have, you know, that whole 140 pairs, let's say on that 10 acres, and then we move them tomorrow. Well, we're moving away from the cycle of that fly larva. So we're quickly then followed by turkeys, you know, and for me, I'm just like, oh, this is when the turkeys show up. And Mark was like, I can't believe how many turkeys I'm seeing out here. I was like, really? I just thought that's what the turkeys just follow the cows. That's what they're, you know, they're nature's pest management. That's what they're doing. And he was blown away by how many turkeys that were out there cleaning up all those patties.
These are wild turkeys. These are not turkeys you're rearing, right?
That's right. No. Wild turkeys that are just coming by, cleaning up all these manure patties. And then now we're seeing that's like the next day the turkeys are there. That next morning when I come out here, I usually disrupt this little flock of turkeys that are all back there. And now we're seeing a bunch of deer that are following the cows, because we've removed all that thatch layer, all that kind of undesirable stuff that now sunlight's actually getting down through that, you know, that canopy that was created by that thatch. So we're seeing all this grass that, you know, usually doesn't grow yet. It will, but it's growing earlier. And it's like we're moving multiple herds, you know, of wildlife. It's really neat. So those are some of the things that like Mark mentioned that he had seen that I just kind of thought, you know, hey, I've been here. This is just the way it works here.
Right. Why do you think that they're eating forage like coyote thatch that they have not before?
You know, I know like someone really smart, like Dr. Alan Williams or Gabe Brown, or that they had to give a really good answer. I mean, I know there's medicinal properties. We've done Brix measurements. So we've taken,
explain that.
So Brix is BRIX. It's like the level of like energy or sugars that are in that plant. And so we've squeezed them and they're like, you know, 14. So it's actually like a higher energy than what right now, a lot of that stuff they're eating is dormant and it's just like roughage.
Right.
Really not got.
Right.
It's not strong feed, you know, whereas that, the coyote brush is green. It's growing. It's in like a vegetative state. It's like has some energy to it. So I think they're going after it because there's a benefit. There's a benefit to it.
Yeah. But you wonder how much of that new interest in feed source that's been around and available for so long,
right,
if that has to do with the change in practice, or if that's one of those things where you say, I'm only, you know, like I'm traveling and Whataburger and Arby's are the only two that are available. And I usually never eat at Arby's, but hell, it's here and I hate Whataburger. Right. So there you go. Right. And because they're confined to a certain area.
Right.
If that is partially why they're eating it, or if there's some other.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a level of competition that is introduced by this, you know, whereas, you know, some people will call it like non-selective grazing because they're entered into this new paddock. And so they're going to go for the green. They're going to go for what's right there. And they see that coyote brush and they go right up to it and start munching on it.
Yeah. We've got a small herd of cattle at our place in Northeast Texas. They're a, they look like a breed of Longhorn, right? It's a Piney Woods cattle. They're a Spanish breed.
Yeah.
It's Agricola is sort of the more official name. Piney Woods is the less official name, but they're a pretty independent breed. They're not generally known for strong meat production. They're more of a pasture management type animal. Right. And in the summer, they're mostly eating down, right? We've got a lot of Bahia and Bermuda grass here. In the winter, when that mostly goes dormant, they start to eat laterally and they'll even start to graze up, right? So a lot of what they've been doing the last month or so, and we don't unfortunately have the space to do the kind of management practices that you're talking about here, but most of that change in consumption happens as a result of what's available. And perhaps to your latter point, what's the most green? So it's an interesting point. I would not have expected to kind of hear you describe those kinds of changes that quickly. 3 months is pretty dang quick.
Yeah. I mean, and I would say, I bet you do have the space for it, you know,
You're
just
probably right. Yeah, that's a good
putting up that
challenge.
single. Yeah, exactly. It's just like another, it's another aspect to it. And you got to think about some of the things that you are spending time on, and you spend a few minutes on this and save yourself some time
Right.
elsewhere,
Right.
you know. Yeah, 3 months is quick. And, you know, these, there's something to say about like adapted genetics and what those cattle will go after. But I mean, we have seen just a huge change in behavior from the cattle, you know. So
Also.
there's every base has this environmental office. Often they have like a, they have cultural sites of significance. So here we have some sites where these rocky outcroppings where Native Americans would work on, you know, whether it's arrowheads or tools. And so they're meant to be excluded. So we're not supposed to graze on top of them. So we'll put out, you know, a single poly wire around these. It's very simple. But the cultural site manager, we brought him out here, and he was just blown away at the like docility of these cows so quickly. He's been here for 31 years, so he's seen, you know, 31 years worth of grazing out here, and he's never been so close to these cows. They allow him, you know, he was able to walk right up to them. They didn't see him and, you know, turn tail and run, which, you know, is, you know, as a producer, a cow that is stressed is not putting on weight, right? It's losing weight as it's turning tail and running. But when it just looks up, sees this guy who, you know, again, it's been here 31 years, and just puts its head right back down and starts eating. And the only person who's surprised is the guy who's been here 31 years. Was like, whoa, I've just never
Right.
seen them. I've never been this close to them where they didn't want to just take off. So
Huh.
we're seeing like this look, this behavior change in the cattle in a really short amount of time as well.
How do you take these lessons learned and make them broader?
I think a lot of us have these big, and it's just normal for us to have these like big, awesome, huge visions, right? And I'm no different. Yes, this is a smaller trial, but the lessons we learn here won't apply to just DOD land, but I mean federal land. You know, you name federal land, they operate under similar policies and procedures. And so this could open up, you know, National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management. I mean, this has applications in a lot of places, but what we've looked at is kind of two lines of effort. One being, how do we expand here in California? And our the next logical expansion is to Camp Roberts, which is about 45 minutes north of here. And that base is about 40,000 acres. Right next to that one is Fort Hunter Liggett, and that's about 160,000 acres. You know, so we see a really easy, and that's, you know, within 90 minutes, you have these three bases. So that just makes sense to us. And where we could implement these practices. Again, it goes back to, we're not turning these bases into a dude ranch. You know, this is
Right.
retargeted.
Right.
Some folks, you know, have referred to, you know, management intensive. You know, this is, we're there at the base. We're interacting with range control. They have copies of my grazing plan, of my map. You know, they can see where I am for that day. You know, it says he's over in the Yankee training area, and he's in these 10 acres that are labeled, you know, 23 December. Like, that's where they
Right.
are. And they
These
tell me.
cattle are not on active live fire ranges, or are they?
No.
Okay.
No. They
Right.
are invited at certain points to go into areas, you know, the range would then be shut down, you know.
Correct.
And
Correct.
so what we want to avoid are some paradigms that some folks have ran into with other bases where, you know, cattle walk out onto the live fire, they have to shut it down. I mean, that's incredible cost incurred there to have a platoon, company, battalion, you know, and on up, who have to sit on their hands, you know, while these cows don't care whether you're shooting a 50 cal or not. They don't care,
Right.
right? So this, again, that kind of goes back to that level of control that we have. So we want to expand here in California, but we also want to expand to other bases that are grazing throughout the DOD, you know, across, you know, Fort Sill, Fort Cavazos, you name it. there's right. a lot of other bases that we could do this at as well.
One of the inherent challenges with projects in any active duty capacity are that they tend to be led by service members who have a assignment time window, right?
Yeah.
So you've got a couple more years maybe for something like this, and then you've got to go serve the needs of the Army elsewhere. And to me, one of the worst things that can happen in this particular situation is that you expand to Camp Roberts and you expand to these other two camps just around in California, perhaps, and you're instituting this practice and you're seeing this huge success, but you're the steward and you're the person at the helm with the microphone. And at the end of this, you have to go do something else. I mean, how do you ensure, or how are you thinking about ensuring that the success that you've garnered
I mean, this is what keeps me up at night and some things I try to think about. Well, one thing I absolutely benefited greatly from was a program called Battlefields to Fertile Fields. And so they offered these scholarships to go to a soil health academy, which I applied for. They paid for half of the tuition, paid for the other half. Went there and just kind of had my mind blown with, you know, not only the what grazing can do, but just the soil health aspect of things, like how complex those microbes and how important they are. And part of that program, it really mainly is these scholarships. Where we'd like to take it is that these bases that are going to be here long after I'm dead and gone, are stewarded by folks who have gone through a program where they would come to Camp San Luis Obispo, they would come to Camp Roberts, and their skill bridge, their on-the-job training, their 6 months would be where they would work hand in hand with myself, with, you know, the consultant company who would come out and say what we're doing, give us another set of eyes. They'd work with range control. They'd work with the environmental office. They'd work with the garrison leadership. All of these folks working together to develop this unique context, this understanding. You know, one of the first soft imperatives we say is understand your operational environment. How important is that, right? And so these bases have a very unique operational environment that veterans are uniquely suited to understand. And so if we could, what I'd like to do, again, this vision is to create this cadre where we are essentially creating the next generation of DOD land managers. So where these bases have a grazing program manager, you know, it's Mike, you know, you work there, you live there, you are the one who maintains this herd, and you closely coordinate with, again, all those key stakeholders that exist on an installation.
That's one of the best answers that you can give for something like that. I mean,
yeah, maybe that should be the whole episode right there. That's it. Boom. Yeah.
The DoD Skills Bridge program is largely new, but if it was something that was possible when I was leaving the service, it would have 100% been something that I would have gone after. That was 2014, right? 10 years ago now. I think it is one of the best things, just from what I know about it, that the military service has done to try to prepare veterans for this transition process is, damn, it doesn't cost the organization anything. In fact, they're getting free labor for 6 months. They don't have to hire this person or persons.
Right.
And it gives the veteran an opportunity to say, is this something that I can be a part of? And I think your thoughts around making this a permanently billeted position, either at the base or at a particular organization that, or organizations that happen to reside on that base, whether it's, you know, whatever group that is around there, or but make that management a responsibility of that entity or entities,
right,
in this curriculum, if you will, that you're helping build right now, becomes replicable at that base, but also your surrounding bases, and perhaps writ large. So, I mean, that's why I say like you're on this cusp of something. It sounds like to me it's huge, and it would be such a shame to have the lessons that you've learned die or leave with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm totally not biased, but I think it's pretty exciting as well. And I mean, that's why this matters. That's why this matters. You know, that's why, right. Like, I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. And this helps get the story out, gets people excited. Like, I hope that someone hears this and like sends me an email and goes, right. Hey, I'm thinking right. about either getting out or, you know, because I don't have these people lined up yet. You know, I don't have all these guys who are like, hey, Mike, here's my, you know, next six bases that are opening up for grazing. Here they are. Right. Like, we don't have them yet. We want them. We've talked with, you know, Understanding Ag about how could we do this? You know, would you propose the curriculum? You know, would Nat GLC, you know, the National Grazing Lands Coalition, would you be part of this? Would you help us develop this cadre? You know, we're having these talks with folks, but, you know, just like, you know, the what is it? The harvest is great and the workers are few.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we still need these folks who want to come out here and learn. And you're right. I mean, the risk is so low for those who are interested in this. You know, not only are we doing a skill bridge, you know, we're giving them their last 6 months, but they're still kind of working for the Army. You know,
right? It's like, yeah, that's right.
Army. You know, they're gonna be out of Pendleton.
Right.
You know, that's where they're gonna be working. You know, it's right. like how risky are we? It's not that. They're right.
Yeah,
here.
It's a good point. It's not one that I had thought about. The other thing that really struck me that you were saying that the two managers, Mark and Blake, who'd been running this property for decades,
mm-hmm.
are so open or were open initially to implementing these new practices, and then have been so vocal, it sounds like, about communicating to others. We're seeing behavior changes. We're seeing animals eat things they haven't eaten before. We're seeing them on pastures and places we haven't seen them before. We're seeing follow-on animals come behind these in quantities and in instances we haven't before. That they were open to that idea. And they're also saying, we're seeing things we haven't seen before, and we can directly attribute them to this practice shift. That's huge.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say that like, we didn't make them nervous. I know when I told Mark, I'm like, okay, no. I mean, I want all the cows in this acre and a half paddock for training. He's like,
wait, what?
There's 140 of, like, then they just had calves. I'm like, yeah, I know, Mark, but we got to train them to this hot wire. We can't just put a hot wire out in space. They're just going to walk right through it. Like and that was another thing I learned at a Soil Health Academy is like, well, how do you do this? How do you even get your animals started? You know? And so it's like, well, we have these two large, essentially like holding pens, you know, one's 5 acres, one's acre and a half, you know? And so like, okay, we're going to start them in there. We need you to bring all the cows in and put them in here. And he was kind of like, all right, you know, I mean, I don't know why Mark trusted me like he did, but I mean, I'm so glad he did.
Yeah. That's crazy though. That, I mean, and so once that happened, right, once they were in this acre and a half or these five acres,
yep.
And they were there for what, a day, 2 days?
Yeah, they were in the acre paddock for 1 day. So we essentially, it's barbed wire is what it is. And then we lined it with a poly wire. This is the training part. And
Got
then
it.
We
okay.
put in, then we subdivided that even more.
Oh boy.
And so then they learned that, hey, you don't mess with this magical white wire. And then instead of running forward, they ran backwards, right? Because they saw the barbed wire, which they already know, but we knew something new. So they knew when they hit it to back up.
How long did that take?
That we had them in there for a day. But they were learning. I mean, we were watching them hit that wire and, you know, like some of them learned faster than others.
Yep.
Certainly. But we had them in there for 24 hours and then we moved them over to the 5 acre where we put out, you know, those like 1,200 to 1,300 pound square bells. And then, so we had five of those square bells and then we had five subdivided paddocks. Each one of them had their own square bell. because there's not enough forage in there to support, you know, those 140 pairs. And then what I would do is I would walk out there. Again, these cows aren't really, they're not used to me yet. So it's kind of, it was stressful, you know, that initial. And I'd start reeling up that wire. So they start hearing the tink, 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 tink with the, of the geared reel, and then hear me yell, "Come, boss." And some of them, the more, you know, docile ones came right up, and we encouraged, and as I walked by, they'd walk up to my simulated greener pasture, new forage, which was the bale of hay. So they walked up there, and then they started eating that. For 2 days, we did that.
Yeah. And Mark and Blake are watching you do this and going, okay.
Yeah. They're watching me do this. Okay. They're watching me do this. They're watching me pick up polywire that would get knocked over from time to time. And they're like, okay, I think, you know, this, it's working in here because of the barbed wire. I don't know if it's going to work, you know, out there. And sure enough, it did. It's not to say we never had like
a
cow or two that were like, hey, Mark, Blake, can you guys come get your tag 32? Because
he's on the highway right now, trucking.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah. less than a week. Right. And these cows are essentially trained.
We did three days, but I mean, there's people who say they do it in hours and their cows are trained to it. We just took 3 days because we had the forage to do it. You know, we had the hay to do it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be so sure. I mean, because there's people firing weapons, you know, like we can, we can see the ranges from those training corrals.
Right. Right.
So I want to make sure those girls were ready before we went out there and we were, you know, doing it live.
Man, this is just wild, Eric. I mean, I don't know much about applying to Naval Postgraduate School.
When you apply to the Naval Postgraduate School, you go before a paper board, you know, so you write an essay saying what you're going to write about. I want to write about what Special Forces is going to do in the deep fires area. You know, how are we going to get resupplied in this world of multi-domain operations? But my wife said, you know, Eric, you're kind of borderline obsessed with this soil health, this grazing stuff. At the time, we were in North Carolina when I'm writing this paper. So we had chickens, pigs, cows, turkeys, doing very much kind of the Joel Salatin homesteading type operation. And then I read Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown. I read that in Afghanistan. Now I need to read holistic management, you know, so I'm reading Alan Savory stuff out there. So going down this rabbit hole, and I am just seeing these connections between, you know, when I was in Africa or when I was in Afghanistan, about like real life food security issues, real effects of what poor land stewardship does, what bare soil at scale does to people in conflict, and how those are inextricably related. I think these are all things like us as like military members just see and get, you know, because we don't realize how good we have it here, you know? So I thought, well, there's definitely a way to create stability in areas of instability through agricultural practices. We know we can do that, but we have, you know, what's the best way to do it? Well, let's test it out. The Army has this Army climate strategy, you know, with this goal of net zero 2050. Every branch has one. So they have these net zero goals. What's the fastest way that we could get to it? Well, we can create these huge carbon sinks out here. So let's see how much carbon we can pull down. And that's kind of like how it started. But I really thought people were going to like put me kind of in a corner and be like, hey, this weird guy wants to write about cows. You know, I even remember going to my advisor, my potential advisor, being really nervous, you know, to be like, I can't believe I'm about to talk to her about cows and grazing, and I'm a special forces officer who wants to talk about cows. And so, but thank God my wife kept saying, you really should do it. You really should talk to your advisor about this. I had not met in her office before. And I remember I'm walking into her office, and I'm still apprehensive about bringing this up. I'm like, not sure if I'm going to do it. And I walk into her office, and she has pictures of cows all over her office. She's from Montana, like grew up ranching. And I'm like, okay, I feel like I can talk to you. is now I want to talk to you about how, you know, grazing can create stability. And she's like, I want to hear it, you know? So then that really like started the snowball of how do we implement this here, mm-hmm. CONUS? Like, let's test this out. Our number one export, you know, as the United States should be knowledge. You know, we have labs, universities, we have this funded research we can do. Like, let's explore this here. Let's make sure it works. And that's what we can talk about. So it's not just me as a special force officer going, hey, this is how you do a raid ambush. Here's, you know, here's the Ranger handbook. I'm going to just go over, you know, troop leading procedures ad nauseum. Like, I always felt like I had a bit of an unfair advantage with a partner force because I could talk to them about agriculture because they're very, very connected to that. So my
right
or I felt was really genuine because my concerns, you know, their concerns became mine quickly as they would talk about, you know, most of them have some type of small farming operation that they're a part of or their immediate family is part of it. And so I always felt like that was a great rapport builder for me. And, you know, it was something that as I talked to people about this at the Naval Postgraduate School, they said, yes, this absolutely makes sense. This is something defense analysis. That's the program that I was a part of and still work for. We 100% will be in this. And then, you know, we'd have these VIP visitors, you know, that General Rainey, the Army's Futures Command commander, you know, 4 stars coming up here. And I'd say, hey, sir, my name's, you know, Major Eric Chai. I'm going to talk to you about cows, you know. And I mean, I thought it was going to be the opposite, right? I thought I was going to be put in this corner and people would be like, hey, this guy's kind of crazy. And it was the total opposite. It was people wanting to hear about it. It was a nature-based solution. It had all these wins, just like we've talked about. You know, it's the ranchers winning, the base is winning, DOD is winning. Like, we just didn't see the downside here.
I also want to ask you, when you were doing your sort of Joel Salatin type exercise in North Carolina, mm-hmm. where did that interest originally stem from? Did you grow up on a ranching background? I mean, where did that idea say, let's try this here at home, so to speak?
I grew up in Wisconsin. Have you ever been there?
No, but I can tell from your accent that's where.
I get that. Well, I get that a lot, but I also hear no to that answer to that question.
I've been all around it, around the periphery of the states, but never Wisconsin proper.
I mean, it's dairy country. So I didn't grow up on a dairy. My wife did, but I did not. You know, I baled hay in the summer and then, you know, cleaned gutters on confinement dairies. So it's just like the real glamorous work, you know?
Absolutely.
So I was like, I wanted to get as far away from it as possible. That's why the Army seemed like the best route to get pretty far from Wisconsin. But once we bought some land in North Carolina and I wanted some shooting lanes, you know, and it was just all this like scrub pine. It's not even good for pulpwood. It was a mess. And a friend of mine said, you know, I have these Ossabau pigs and we could sprinkle some corn around the roots of these things and at the base of these trees. And you could have yourself some like 4-legged bulldozers, you know? And so like, I started just thinking of different ways because hiring heavy equipment is really expensive. So we just kind of started building, you know, I put pigs in there with poultry netting, you know, and contain the pigs. And then we're like, well, what's the next? Well, we have all these ticks and, spiders and chiggers in North Carolina. I need chickens and guineas and turkeys. And so just kind of started compounding. And then, you know, as all this grass starts growing, I'm like, well, I don't want to mow all this stuff. Like, let's get some cows out here. Like, let's put up some fence and put cows out there. And then we just started getting everyone working together, you know.
Interesting. Yeah, you don't normally hear about that as that sort of progressive necessity, I guess would be a good phrase to see that, right? Like it started as one problem that was solved one way. And then you had, since that was successful, let's try other natural based solutions to other natural problems. And at the end of the day, you've got a system now.
Right. Right. Trying to like create a functioning ecosystem.
Man, this has been just fascinating. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have?
Yeah, I just really want to drive home the point of that getting out to one of those soil. I probably underrepresented how impactful the Soil Health Academy was for me and the opportunity. And it wasn't like when I went there, it wasn't like one or two other guys and girls who applied for the Battlefields, the Fertile Fields program. Like there were six of us. And then I went to another one, there were eight of us. There's quite a few, and it's a great 3 days. It is intense. It's half the day in the classroom, half the day in the field. And I just can't really emphasize how impactful that was for me to there's just a big difference between like knowledge and understanding. And so I'd read a lot of books and even done it to some extent, but not at the scale I'm doing it now. So without creating that network that gets created at those, to because there's been some days out here, Mike, that were like really hard.
Yeah, I
They were like
suspect
really
so.
challenging. And I'm
Yeah.
like, what am I doing? Like this is tough. And so without that network and that community of people who are like, hey, Eric, hang in there, man. Like this is you're at the beginning stages. It's gonna be tough, but keep your head up.
With the current wildfires in California, this was a timely conversation with Eric. The thatch layer that he describes is a common ground cover in this part of California, and Eric's proof of concept project is helping to manage that fuel source through these targeted grazing practices. This method of adaptive multi-paddock grazing is not new or novel, but if it's new to you, then it's also novel. This method of land and herd management seems to be a new concept, however, to many of the DoD managers and their facilities teams. If this proof of concept can scale to other bases within California, and if the measured benefits of these practices can be enough to change the minds of traditional ranchers, then this program has real potential to affect meaningful change. I told Eric during the interview that one of my biggest fears with this is that he's able to record and prove all of these benefits and his program is a real success. But because of the nature of military assignments, when it comes time for him to be transferred, then this program dies with him. He seemed very cognizant of that fear and appeared to be putting practices and methods in place to ensure that doesn't happen. If you'd like to find out more about the Our Goal program, you can reach out to Eric directly by email at Eric, so E-R-I-C, dot Chia, C-Z-A-J-A, at N. PS.edu. Eric is also pretty active on LinkedIn under his name, and they also put out a regular situation report. So shoot him an email and he'd be happy to add you to that list.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vets and Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. If you enjoyed this episode and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from these insights and stories, please give us a review and share on social media. You can also find previous episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, please send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Dessau, and until next time, stay frosty.